book of Genesis, chapter 20. Genesis, chapter 20. As you're turning there, I want to tell you about three people this morning. First one is a lady named Jessica. Jessica struggles with bitterness. Her husband left her and her young children a few years ago for a younger, what he considered to be more beautiful woman. Jessica is now working two jobs trying to make ends meet. She's really trying to forgive her ex-husband, but she's struggling with bitterness and resentment. She grew up in church. She believes in and once held very strongly to the sovereignty of God in her life, and could one time tell you and I about stories about how God had worked in her life, but right now she's really just struggling through the reality of the life that she's living. She once attended church, she once believed in the sovereignty of God, but now she's kind of taken a fatalistic outlook in her life. She kind of thinks, you know, if there is a God, and I really believe there is, but he's kind of out there, he's distant somewhere, he's some cold, distant reality, and he really doesn't care about me. I mean, after all, if God cared about me and my circumstances and my situation, wouldn't he be doing something to spare me and my children the pain of this terrible circumstance? That's Jessica. The next individual is a man named Ron. Ron is a very driven man, a very wealthy man, a very, in the eyes of the world at least, a very successful man. Ron's got a lot of toys. He really enjoys his lifestyle. He really enjoys the things that his money brings to him. And on the outside, he looks cool, calm, and collected. He looks like he's got it all together. But when he gets home with his family, he often erupts like a volcano. Many people on the outside don't see it, but he's a man who is deeply angered. He often resorts to violent outbursts between himself and his wife and his children. But on the outside, everything looks good. And yes, he once was a Sunday school teacher and a deacon in his church. He once believed strongly in the power and sovereignty of God, but now he's kind of adopted the attitude that says, well, God's powerful, and God has saved me, and since I have this fire insurance, I can pretty much do whatever I want. I mean, kind of the, you know, once saved, always saved. I prayed a prayer one time, and God has covered my sins, and now I can just do whatever I want. It doesn't matter what I do. And his attitude is basically this: I really enjoy sinning. God enjoys forgiving. This is a great relationship. Let's just keep this thing up. Well, that's Ron. Then there's a guy named Greg, and Greg is really struggling right now. Greg is working hard to support his family. He's working hard to be a good and an honorable man. But Greg has kind of a secret hidden sin. You see, when his family goes to bed at night and they get the kids all tucked in, Greg often finds himself in the basement in front of his computer serving his pornography addiction. And Greg is really struck by this. He's trying to figure out how to get out of this addiction, but it seems as though every time he takes a step away from it, he's right back in it, and it's really causing a lot of grief and heartache in his life. Here's the difference in the life of Greg. Greg has confessed his sin to his wife. He has confessed his sin to his pastor and to brothers and sisters in his church that he trusts, that he knows will walk with him and hold him accountable and help him through this struggle. And Greg is walking by the grace of God now in obedience and in faithfulness to God. He still struggles with lust. He still struggles with sin. He still struggles with all these thoughts and all these things that he's done in the past. And he still struggles with those things. And every once in a while, he finds himself falling again and committing those sins again. And yet he knows that he's walking a path of repentance. He's walking with brothers and sisters who will call him out when he sins and will hold him accountable. Now, Jessica and Ron and Greg are fictional people. I don't know who they are. I just made them up. But here's the reality this morning. Jessica and Ron and Greg represent a poignant reality that each and every one of us face. Every single one of us struggles this morning with sin. It may be lust. It may be pride. It may be the sin of gluttony. It may be the sin of anger. It may be fear or worry. It may be resentment or unforgiveness. And the list could go on and on and on. But whatever the particular sin may be, whatever the struggle you may have, the reality is each and every one of us here today struggle with sin. I struggle with sins that many of you probably don't. You probably struggle with sins that possibly have never even occurred to me. But the reality is, each and every one of us struggle with sin in our lives. The reality is, we are all fallen human beings, we're all fallen creatures, and we all have to deal with the reality of sin in our lives. And maybe you've been asking yourself the same question we all ask at times. It kind of goes something like this. If we're Christians, if we've truly been saved, if we are under the blood, then why do we still struggle with sin? I mean, have you ever known that struggle in your life? If you're not, then we might need to come check your pulse because you're probably not breathing. We all struggle with sin in our lives. Have you ever found yourself puzzled by that and struggling through, God, you've saved me, you've bought me back, you've done all these things in my life, and yet I still find myself falling into sin, and over and over and over again, I find myself having to come back and ask for forgiveness, and ask for repentance, and confess, and on and on and on it goes. A lot of us have battle scars from the sins we've struggled with the sins that have ensnared us in our lives. And you can respond to sin in your life in one of three ways. You can respond like Jessica and become fatalistic. Well, whatever will be, and I can't really do anything about it. God's sovereign, God's in control. I can't really do anything to improve my lot in this life, and so I guess I'll just sort of roll with the punches and go along and get along. God's sovereign, he doesn't care. He's not involved in the intimate details of my life. So I'm going to lose all hope and just kind of have despair in my life because God's so distant. Or you can say, well, God is powerful and God is sovereign and God has saved me. And he sure has shown me grace. I love sinning. God loves forgiving. This is a great relationship. Let's just move ahead with this thing. I can do whatever I want because after all, God's sovereign, right? God's just going to have his will anyway. God's just going to do whatever he wants. And so it really doesn't matter the measly little details of my life. I can just get away with whatever I want. Or you can believe in the power of the gospel and the grace of God, and you can live in godliness, seeking Christ with everything that you have. Seeking Christ with everything that you are. I mean, it's really the three options we have. We can either throw our hands up in the air and say, well, I'll never be good enough and I'll never reach, you know, whatever the goal is. And so I'm just going to give up. It's all sort of fatalism. Or responding the other way and saying, well, I've got this fire insurance, so I'm just going to go on with what I've been doing all along anyway. Or you can realize the reality of sin in your life. You can realize that you're never going to be completely free from the chains of sin until one day you find yourself in glory with Christ. You know, that's just a beautiful reality that at the moment of salvation, we are broken free from the chains of sin that bind us to this world, but we're still living in the flesh. We're still living in a human body and we still struggle You know, Paul talks on and on in his epistles about how, you know, the war between the flesh and the spirit. And he even says at one point, you know, all the things that I want to do, I don't do any of that stuff. And all these things that I hate and despise and I know are sin, and those are the things that my flesh goes after. And even the Apostle Paul recognized this war within himself. So how do we square these two things? How do we square the sovereignty of God with our own sinfulness? And we've got to ask ourselves this question. Can God's sovereign faithfulness overcome our sinful failures? Please don't raise your hand, but how many of you struggle not only with sin in your life, but with the same repeated sin over and over and over again? That it's just like, well, I don't deal with gluttony, but this issue of anger just keeps popping up in my life. Or I don't struggle with the sin of unforgiveness, but this deal with pornography just keeps making its way around in my life. Or maybe I don't struggle with pornography, but you know, I can't find myself forgiving this person or doing this or doing that. Whatever it is, do you ever find yourself dealing over and over again with the same repeated sin? And you wonder, how is God going to overcome my faithlessness with his faithfulness, especially repeated failures? Well, the passage we come to this morning in Genesis chapter 20 deals with just such an issue in the life of a man who most of us would consider to be the epitome of a man of faith. I mean, after all, when you read about Abraham later on in the Bible, when you read about Abraham in books like Romans and Galatians and Hebrews and James, all throughout the New Testament, when it talks about Abraham, do you remember anything about the failures of Abraham? Do you remember anything being mentioned there about how, you know, this guy believed in God, but, you know, he took this this young servant girl that was his wife's slave girl, and he had another child by her. And when he went to Egypt, he really didn't trust God. And he told Pharaoh that his wife Sarah was actually his sister, which was kind of a half-truth. And we all know that a half-truth is a whole lie. And we know the heart behind Abraham's statement. We know what he was trying to do. And he was trying to deceive. And we don't read anything about that in the New Testament, do we? Over and over and over again in the New Testament, Abraham is brought up and he is presented to us as this great man of faith. And indeed he was. But when we come to Genesis, we find a few times where Abraham really messes up. I mean, really just blows it completely. So I want you to turn with me to Genesis 20, and we're going to begin reading in chapter 20 and verse 1. This really isn't that long a chapter compared to some of the others in Genesis. But it's a story of Abraham and Abimelech. And I'll just tell you, if you get into the middle of this and you start feeling like you've got deja vu, it's because you do. Because this has happened before. Not with Abimelech, but with Pharaoh in Egypt, almost the exact same story. Sodom and Gomorrah have just been destroyed in Genesis chapter 19. We come to the end of chapter 19 and Abraham looks out over the valley and he sees the smoke going up from those cities. He sees that God has poured his wrath out on Sodom and Gomorrah. And we see the end of chapter 19, the whole escapade with Lot and his daughters and all that fiasco and that mess. The Bible tells us in verse 1, from there, Abraham journeyed toward the territory of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur. And he sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Now Abimelech had not approached her, so he said, "Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister'? And she herself said, 'He is my brother.' In the integrity of my heart, in the innocence of my hands, I have done this." Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart. And it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Don't miss how God says this to Abimelech. Verse 7. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. So Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told them all these things. And the men were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you did this thing?" Abraham said, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, 'This is the kindness you must do to me. At every place to which we come, say of me, he is my brother.'" Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah his wife to him. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you." To Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you, and before everyone you are vindicated." Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and also healed his wife and female slaves so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Well, that's an interesting story. Like I said, kind of reminds us of something we read 8 chapters earlier in Genesis chapter 12. Abraham did this same stunt, pulled the same thing on Pharaoh in Egypt. You'd have thought he'd have learned after all that and kind of getting away with it. You'd have thought he'd have went, "Wow, that was dumb. That was stupid. And maybe I should never do that again. And so I'm just going to move on learn from this mistake and never do this again," right? But here we come, and it's not like it's yesterday. This is 25 years later, at least. We read about Abraham and Pharaoh in the beginning of his journey away from Ur of the Chaldeans, and we come up against Abraham. Isaac's fixing to be born. I mean, this is 25 years after the promise. This is after Ishmael has been born. This is after God has changed Abram's name to Abraham. He's changed Sarai to Sarah. He's done all this work in Abraham's life. And here we come 2.5 decades later, and Abraham is facing the same exact sin that he faced in Genesis chapter 12. It's a repeat all over again of what he'd already done in the past. Repeated failures. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? You know why it sounds familiar? Because Abraham is not alone in this passage. Abraham is doing the same thing. You've got to remember, Abraham is a man. He's a human being just like you and I. Abraham has to deal with the sin issue in his life. And even though he's a man of faith, even though he's been trusting God, we see these moments, these markers in his life where it's obvious his faith is faltering. It's obvious his faith is failing because he's not being faithful to God. He's being faithless, which is causing him to venture into sin. See, the problem here is that Abraham is not regarding God as great. He is not seeing God as glorious. He is not seeing God in this moment as the supreme good and as gracious. The reality is Abraham is terrified. Abraham's scared. And it would seem as though from the text that this is sort of a deal that Abraham and Sarah kind of had worked out with them when they first left Abraham's father's property in Ur of the Chaldeans. It's almost like when they first get on the road, Abraham goes, "Okay, now we're going to come to some places, and you're a very beautiful woman, and the reality is, as sojourners, as refugees, as it were in that day, You know, when we come into these, some of these places, it's very realistic to think that they might kill me because you're so beautiful. And so some of these people might kill me and take you as their own wife. And so here's what we'll do, Sarah. Well, you say that you're my sister. I'll say that I'm your brother. And that way, maybe they won't kill me. This is all about I don't want to die, right? This is all revolving around Abraham's fear of man. Every time this pops up, every time this happens, whether it's with Pharaoh or Abimelech, or whether it's the sin with Hagar in chapter 16, whatever it is, each of these markers in Abraham's life, we're seeing that Abraham is a great man of faith. But in these moments, Abraham's faith is failing. Abraham is looking around going, man, God's not working the way I want God to work. God's not moving the way I want God to move. And so I've got to take control. I've got to come in and I've got to make sure this thing works out just right. I'm kind of afraid of this man, this king, Abimelech in Gerar. And I'm afraid of King Pharaoh in Egypt. And I'm fearful of what these people are going to think. I'm fearful about what these people are going to do to me. And so I've got to concoct this whole plan. We all deal with it. We all face times of a lack of faith in our lives. No matter how much faith we have, I can almost guarantee you we could go around this room this morning and we could all give testimony of times where we could say, you know what, I've seen God move I don't know how many times in my life, and yet for some unexplained reason other than I'm just a sinner, I can't come up with any other explanation than that, but I failed to believe God was good and glorious and gracious and that he was the greatest thing in my life at this moment, and I failed God. We all deal with this. We all understand where Abraham's at in Genesis chapter 20. So what I want us to do in the time we have remaining is just look at three things very simply from this text that I think emerge that speak to us about this issue of repeated failure. First of all, let's just take a look, just for a few moments, at Abraham's stupid plans and how they resulted in specific failures. You know, as you read through this chapter, we find, first of all, that Abraham's first specific sin, his first specific failure, is that he feared man. He feared man more than he feared God. He was more afraid of what man could do to him than what God would do to him for his lack of faith. Isn't it amazing how sin does that in our lives? I mean, sin just makes us stupid, right? I mean, it just really, if we were to just take 2 seconds, it's like, okay, I'm going to commit this sin, but let me just put my life on pause right now and walk over here and think this thing out. That's why we sin, right? Because we don't put it on pause and think it out and think through all the consequences. We just go, ooh, sin. Let me just run over here and enjoy this. By the way, don't ever let anybody tell you sin is not fun. Sin is a blast. If it wasn't a blast, if it wasn't fun, you wouldn't do it. It doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't make it not wrong. But in our flesh, sin is fun. That's why we do this stuff. That's why men cheat on their wives, because they're thinking, hey, I'm going to have a little fling here, and it's going to be fun. It's going to add a little spice to my life that I haven't ever had before. And that's why people get hooked on drugs. Hey, this drug offers me something right now that I've never experienced before. I'm going to have this new experience. I'm going to have this new thing in my life, and this is going to cure all my problems. And it does for a few minutes while you're not thinking about anything. Guess what? The problem with drugs is you always come off of them. And then you've got to have another high, and you've got to have something more powerful to counteract the last one. I mean, the last one was a good high while it lasted, but that's not any good for you anymore. I mean, after all, you've already experienced that. And we see this in every aspect of our lives where we find sin. In the flesh, sin is fun. Problem is, it's fun on credit, and that bill always comes due. We don't think about the consequences while we're committing the sin. We just think, man, this is fun. Abraham feared man more than he feared God. Not only that, his second specific failure, there's a whole lot of stuff that we could kind of massage out of this, but I mean, just specific. We're just talking 4 very blatant things that come out of this passage. The second one is that he lied about Sarah. Now, yes, it was technically true that she was his half-sister. You know, Abraham explains that to Abimelech later on. But you notice he doesn't offer that explanation on the front end. He doesn't offer the explanation, hey, this is my wife Sarah. By the way, she's also my half-sister and blah, 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 blah. No, he doesn't mention that in the beginning. It's just, she's my sister. The problem here becomes in Abraham's mentality, in his, what he's meaning to do is to mislead Abimelech. He's afraid that Abimelech is going to kill him, which, by the way, is not an unfounded fear. This was something in this society and in the time in which Abraham and Abimelech lived. This would have been very common for somebody to be a refugee, to be a sojourner, to come into the land, and for whoever's in charge, whoever is more powerful, to come and to kill that man, to take his wife. It's not like this would be the first time it ever happened. So it's not that Abraham's fears are unfounded. The problem becomes he's not trusting God in the face of his problems. He's trying to be in control instead of realizing God is in control. He's trying to manipulate his situation to get what he wants. And so he fears man, which leads him to lie about Sarah. He also, the third very specific failure, he slanders the character of Abimelech. Now, Abimelech is this pagan king. But when you read this passage, who comes out smelling more like roses? I mean, who looks better character-wise between Abraham and Abimelech in Genesis 20? Well, it's not Abraham. It seems as though Abimelech kind of takes the high road. It seems as though Abimelech is like, what did I ever do to you? I mean, I could understand if you punched me in the nose because I punched you, but dude, I haven't done anything to you. Why have you brought this evil upon me? And you see this slander in verse 11. Abraham asks you, why did you do this? And Abraham's response, well, I just knew there was no fear of God in this entire place. It's like if somebody asked you that, and you just look at it and say, well, I know you're a pagan and a heathen, and I know you're just a terrible, wicked, awful person. I don't know anything about you, but I know you're bad. It's like Abraham just made assumptions about this guy just right off the cuff. And it's almost like Abimelech is looking at him and going, dude, if you ever just took a minute to get to know me, maybe you'd have realized something different. But no, you just made these assumptions, and so you slandered my character. And then the final area where Abraham really just messes up, he is risking the birth of Isaac. You just look at the whole narrative. You look at the whole thing and what's going on. Isaac's coming up in chapter 21. He has been promised for decades. Abraham has already tried to short-circuit God's way, and he's already found that has failed miserably. And yet here we find Abraham risking the birth of the promised son. He's literally laying the whole history and future of Israel on the line because he would rather fear man than fear God. It was a stupid plan. It resulted in specific failures. But the second great truth we see this morning out of this text is that God's sovereign promises result in steady faithfulness. You know, it's amazing. Biblical author puts it like this. You know, if we deny him, he's going to deny us. If we do this, he's going to do that, and back and forth. You remember what he says? If we are faithless, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. God has always had a plan. God has always been sovereign. God has always been in charge. And you just see this steadiness with God. Nothing changes because Abraham decides to be an idiot. Nothing changes in the grand scheme of God's plan. Because, I mean, you even see God works through Abraham's sin in this. You come to the end of the chapter, and Abimelech is so ready to get rid of Abraham, he basically gives the bride price for Sarah. I mean, by the way, have you ever thought about, she's about 98, 99 years old at this point. Man, she must have been a looker. For a 99-year-old woman, for this guy to go, hey, I'm going to take her out. I'm going to have her in my harem. And yet, through the sovereignty of God, we find out that Abimelech never touched Sarah. Why? Because notice what God says. He's speaking to Abimelech in this dream, and he says, it was me that kept you from doing this. I know you're innocent. And the reason you're innocent, Abimelech, is not because of you and your uprightness and your great character. The reason that you are blameless in this is because of me and my sovereignty and what I've done. I have prevented you from committing this great sin. It was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. God's sovereign promises resulted in steady faithfulness. God is always faithful to himself and to his word. And that's basically the story. Abraham messes up royally again. Abimelech is like, dude, what's up? He gives him basically the bride price, which basically says to everybody, I haven't touched her. She's pure. She's clean. Nothing has happened to this woman. He gives her back to her husband, which, by the way, it's kind of, I don't know if it's a little dig or what, but you notice Abimelech at the end, he gives Abraham all this stuff. And in verse 16, to Sarah, Abimelech says, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Isn't it interesting? After he's found out that, not brother-sister relationship, this is a husband-wife deal going on, he turns to Sarah and goes, I've given your brother, since you guys want to refer to each other as brother and sister, I've given your brother slash husband 1,000 pieces of silver, all these goats, all these oxen, all this stuff. Here's my land. You just go wherever you want to go. I mean, that's basically the story. And Abraham, you know, comes out not really smelling like roses, but looking pretty good. I mean, he got a bunch of wealth out of it. He got a bunch of servants out of it. And God has spared him what could have been some pretty drastic consequences in this case yet again. And so this morning, just a few minutes, I want to focus on how God's sovereignty intersects with our sinfulness, how it informs our thinking and it infiltrates our behavior. I want to, because it's kind of hard, isn't it, to take Genesis 20 and see how this really applies to my life. I mean, it's kind of difficult to see, well, what does Abraham and Abimelech have to do with me in 2017 in Rapid City, South Dakota? Well, I think it has several things to do with us, and I think it applies in several ways. And God's sovereignty intersects with our sinfulness, informs our thinking, infiltrates our behavior. Now, we need to say right up front, there are two dangers here. The two dangers are what we talked about earlier. First being fatalism. You know, whatever will be, will be. It's just the way it is. We can't change it. We can't really do anything to better our lot here. God's sovereign. God exists, but he's cold and distant and out there, and he doesn't really care about my individual life. That's one way we can respond. That's one extreme. In fact, in Isaiah chapter 40, there's an interesting passage that speaks to us about the sovereignty of God, speaks to us about his power. In verse 26, Isaiah 40, it says, lift up your eyes, O, on high, and see who created these. Who brings out their hosts by number, calling them by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he is strong in power, not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases his strength. Even youth shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. But they who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles, and they shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. See, the problem is many of us look at life and we say, sure, God's sovereign. God controls the cosmos. He keeps planets from bumping into one another. But, you know, my life is just too minuscule and too insignificant for God to really care about little old me, right? God controls the planets, but what we need to understand is that God is also in control of his people. God's sovereignty. Don't miss this. God's sovereignty is not this harsh reality in our lives. God's sovereignty ought to be a soft pillow you lay down on every single night. You can rest because God's going to work all things according to the counsel of his will. Is that not a liberating understanding, a liberating feeling to know I'm not in control? I don't have to fix everything. There's the extreme of fatalism that we need to be aware of. But then you go to the other end, and there's what I call sort of this extreme of license or sort of cheap grace, where we just say, you know, I realize I sin and I do bad stuff, but once saved, always saved, right? I mean, I prayed the prayer, I got my fire insurance, now I can do whatever I want. That's cheap grace. Paul himself in Romans chapter 6. You remember what Paul said to the Romans? He's going on and on talking about grace and talking about our sin. And he really hits home on the idea and the fact that we ought not to be sinning. And the way he does that in verse 15, he says, what then? Are we to sin because we are not under the law but under grace? By no means. Paul is reacting against this idea that says, well, hey, I love to sin. God loves to forgive. Let's just keep this relationship going. Paul says, by no means. Do you not know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. But thanks be to God that you who were once slaves of sin have become obedient from the heart to the standard of teaching to which you were committed. And having been set free from sin, have become slaves of righteousness. Here's a paradox for you. If you're a Christian this morning, you are bound in freedom. So many people say, well, I want to be autonomous. I want to do whatever I want to do. No, here's the deal. Just square with this right now. You are going to be a slave to something. You don't get to be your own boss. You don't get to call the shots. Somebody calls the shots for you. Either you're a slave to sin and sinfulness of the devil and all that is calling the shots, or you're a slave to Christ and to righteousness. One way or the other, you're a slave. The question is, whose slave do you want to be? Who do you want to be your master? Paul says, we don't go on sinning that grace may abound. In fact, Paul's argument is that God's sovereignty is a motivation for us not to sin. Did you catch that? God's sovereignty is a motivation in our lives for us not to sin. You say, well, how in the world can that be? Well, in Titus chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, Scripture says, for the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age. There's where the rubber meets the road, right? I mean, that's what we're all looking for. Sure, Abraham and Abimelech, all this mess happened years and years ago. What does that have to do with me? What is Abraham's righteousness or faithfulness or faithlessness? What does that have to do with me? It has to do with the fact that we all understand Abraham's position because we all suffer from his condition. We all suffer with sin in our lives. But God's sovereignty is a motivation for us not to sin. Four ways, and we'll be finished. First of all, if we truly believe that God is sovereignly great, then we don't have to be in control. That is a liberating feeling. You see, the problem with so many of us is we're control freaks, right? I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but how many of you in here are control freaks? I don't have to ask for a show of hands. I can just watch all the spouses elbow their spouse and all the kids kind of kick mom or dad under the table, or mom and dad, you know, kind of just giving that look at the kids. You know, many of us suffer from, you know, this control freak symptom where, you know, we've just got to be in control of everything. I struggle, just confession time for the pastor, I guess, here. There are times where there are things in my life that are happening that even the smallest little minute details, I don't want somebody else doing it. I need to do it. You know, there are times like if I'm taking a trip or even if Jennifer and I are going somewhere, she'll go, oh, well, just throw all your stuff in the bag or throw it all out or what do you need? I'll throw it all in the suitcase. Now, here's the difference in me and her. She'll take all her stuff and she'll just sort of throw it on the bed and go, okay, I got to go to work or I got something else I'm doing. You pack suitcases better than I do, so you just put all my stuff in the suitcase. And she just trusts, as crazy as she is, she just blind faith trusts that when she gets to wherever she's going, all her stuff is going to be there. And half the time she's looking at me going, why didn't you put this in the bag? Well, because you trusted me to do it. Well, that's why. You know, for me, I'm like, no, don't pack my bag. Don't do my... I've got to know everything because when I'm missing something, I've got to be able to go back in my mind and think, okay, when did I put this in the bag and when did I put that in the bag? I'm kind of a control freak about the way that my luggage is packed. And when I'm going somewhere away from my comfort zone, away from... I want to know what's in the bag. Now, that's crazy. That's stupid. That's, you know, whatever. But how many of us do things like that in life? In areas that are far more important and far more significant than in whether or not we packed four pair of socks instead of three. We all deal, me included, we deal with this control freak syndrome where we want to be in control. We don't want somebody else calling the shots. We all love the idea of absolute autonomy. None of us have it, but we love the idea. But if we truly believe that God is sovereignly great, then we don't have to be in control. His sovereignty becomes that soft pillow you can lay on at night and understand God's got everything in control. The only reason an asteroid isn't going to strike our planet tomorrow is because God is in control, not because I can control it. It's all because of God. We see this in Hollywood, don't we? I mean, the whole asteroid thing. We make movies in Hollywood about it. Armageddon. Oh, well, we'll just strap up and cowboy up and we'll just build our own rocket ship and we'll go up and we'll just blow that thing to smithereens and we'll never have to deal with it. I mean, we have that mentality in our lives. This catastrophic danger is coming, but we can control it. We can be in charge. If we truly believe that God is sovereignly great, we don't have to be in control. Bert Parsons put it like this. If you don't believe God is sovereign, you have every reason to worry today. You ever thought about that? If you don't believe God is sovereign, you have every reason in the world to worry today. Because you realize if he's not in control, then somebody else must be, and that's a terrifying thought. Second, if we truly believe that God is sovereignly glorious, then we don't have to fear others. Now, fear of others comes in a lot of different forms. For Abraham, it was the fear that Abimelech very well could kill him and take his wife. For you, it may be a little bit different. It may be something like this. Well, I can't do this or I can't say that because I'm worried what this person over here is going to think about me. I'm worried about what this person over here is going to say about me. I'm worried... Fear of others comes in all sorts of different boxes and shapes and forms, right? But if we truly believe that God is sovereignly glorious, we don't have to worry about other people. Our focus will be on Him. Our focus will be on diminishing ourselves so that we can have the clearest possible view of who He is and get a glimpse of His glory. Isn't this what Moses prayed for? Isn't this what Moses begged God for? Show me your glory. Yeah, I see all this wickedness and all this filth and all this trash around me. I want to see your glory, God. Third, if we truly believe that God is sovereignly good, then we don't have to look in other places to find goodness. How many of us walk around trying to find the best of this or the best of that, and settling for this and settling over here, and not, you know, if we just took a moment to realize the supreme good in this universe is God Himself, and if we spent our time and our effort and our money and our talents and our all the other things that God has blessed us with going after Him, the ultimate good, we wouldn't be so worried about all the rest. But so often we don't believe that God is sovereignly good, and that leads us into sin because we're looking for goodness somewhere outside of God. By the way, all these things lead us to sin. If we don't believe that God is sovereignly great, it leads us into sin looking for greatness somewhere else. It leads us to be the control freak. It leads us to try to take control of every aspect of our lives. If we don't believe that God is sovereignly great and glorious, then it leads us to sin in the area of fear of others. If we don't believe that God is sovereignly good, then it sends us outside of who God is looking for goodness. But ultimately, fourth, if we truly believe that God is sovereignly gracious, then we don't have to try to prove ourselves and earn His favor. Do you know what I see in so many churches today? In the lives of so many Christians today, they're running around, running themselves ragged because they're trying to earn something that you cannot buy. They're trying to earn the grace of God, and it comes freely. Give up trying to earn favor with God. Just give up that pursuit. Because anything that you can do, here's the way Isaiah put it. Your best is filthy rags. Like, you put those two things on the scale, our best, the filthy rags just sort of balances the scale. That's exactly what they are. What you need is to remove your works, put the works of Christ on that, and then His blood just covers the scale. And when God looks at you, He does not see you. He's looking upon the shed blood of His Son, Jesus Christ. And that is what He finds great. That is what He finds glorious. That is what God finds good. And that moves Him to grace.